Hi, I'm Nick Fillingham, and welcome to my two guests in the studio, Bill Buxton and Albert Shum. Hi, guys.
Hey.
Thank you for being here. Now, we're just on 2 weeks until the Mix 2010 conference in Vegas, and we thought it'd be a great opportunity to get two of you here in the Channel 9 studios to have a relatively introductory discussion about user experience as a lead-up to Mix to hopefully garner some interest in some of the topics you guys will be covering at the Mix conference.
Sure.
So I have a list here of some relatively open-ended questions about user experience. I'm very new to the user experience world, so I'm very interested in not only your answers here, but hopefully educating me on some of the fundamentals and the principles, and maybe some other people will be in a similar position. Bill, I thought we might start with you. Again, a very open-ended question, but for user experience developers or designers, whichever term you'd like to use, how do you find that balance between function and appeal? Can there be a balance between function and appeal?
So,
feel free to reword the question.
There's an old expression, at least in Canada, like that's a when did you stop beating your wife kind of question.
And we're done. Thanks very much. And elaborate on that.
In terms of answering it, do you assume that there is this tension between functionality
and that they're opposed somehow?
That they're opposed sometimes.
Okay.
And in fact, there's the point I guess would make is that it presupposes that the functionality and great functionality isn't greatly enhanced by desirability or isn't desirable in and of itself. And so it's a quality of experience when you're exercising that functionality. And that's not gratuitous lollipops or window dressing. It's actually part of the elegance of the flow and your perception. If you just have this attractive, appealing stuff tacked on, that's like fashion or styling. It could be gratuitous, and there's a legitimate aspect of design. We see that in automotive and fashion, like high fashion, haute couture, where that's perfectly legitimate. But it's you probably, in many things we're doing, you want to be very conservative about that part of it and have the desirability embedded right in with how you implement the functionality. And what this does, when you put these things in opposition, you tend to pit the engineer and the technologist that's implementing against the design professional, when in fact, for you to have great design, you need those two working in complete interdependent. Each is essential, but neither is sufficient. But they have to be working from the very beginning closely together, or else you lose on both counts.
Now, are there some simple rules, some commandments, if you will, that UX designers and developers should be thinking about when they're trying to tackle that problem? Are there some simple scriptures that people should remember, or can you not break it down that basically?
Well, my view is on any product or any project that if you don't have actually a triad of people, a design professional, a technology professional, and a business professional, each with equal levels of technique and competence in their respective professions, but also with equal levels of creativity in their own profession, working together from day one as peers, you'll have a substandard product. The notion that you can do the engineering and the functionality and specify all that and then have the design come in after is like putting lipstick on the pig. And if you have them there at the beginning, it's a trade-off. It's a little bit like the relationship between an architect in a building and the structural engineer.
Sure.
When Frank Gehry comes up with these whacked out designs, like he really, I hope, this might be a script. That's kind of how he sketches.
Okay.
And then some engineers say, well, it won't stand up or it'll cost way too much. The money person says, you know, that can't happen. The engineer says, I can build it, it'll cost this much. And the financier is going to say, you can never do it. But then the financial guy says, well, if you can put another story in the building, we could sell that retail space, that'll help pay for it. And the engineer will say, well, if you do that, I can do this. And then is that good enough for you, Frank, if we just modify it that way? And you come to this compromise. The myth is that design is this sort of design-led, we're going to show you and all the rest fall behind. No, it's a compromise. Every aspect of product design is a compromise. Great design happens when you have great people working and make the best compromises.
Albert, over to you. You're coming from the Windows Phone 7 group. If you want to just elaborate on that, just really with respect to how your team has approached the redesign of the Windows Phone, what are some of the challenges you guys faced with function versus appeal, and how did you go about addressing those?
Yeah, I think totally on the same page with Bill. It's always been, you know, we call it in shorthand BXT, the balance. And in some ways, we really step back and say, hey, what is the holistic way of building an experience? And experience is a component of balancing the design, the desirability, and the function, the usability, and also I think the usefulness of the product. Hey, why is this product there? What's it for? And understanding all those elements and then creating what we really early on adopted a set of principles to balance those elements is probably the key part that oftentimes you just kind of, let's all start designing and not really understand, hey, are there a set core principles that we really believe in fundamentally? And that translates across the business and the technology and the design. And for us, we really latches on, we really want to create a core set of experience principles for us to use as a reference point. And for Seven, those principles were grounded on three things, and maybe it's the rule of threes. But one key element was around making it personal, a personal theme, and that's really about expressing the experience that enriches, makes it your way, the way you want it. So how do you make things more personal? Another theme that we really dive deep into was, I think, the idea of making it relevant, knowing where you are, knowing who people you are with. How do you explore that theme to deliver an experience? And the last one, it speaks to, I think, kind of the future where we're going. I think, you know, a phone, a mobile, you're always connected. And what does that mean? What are you connected to? Are you connected to your stuff on the phone, but also are you connected to stuff around you or and the cloud? And what does that enhance those experiences? I think those are the three kind of key experience theme that allowed us to balance the X, B, and the T to deliver a better product.
Yeah, the BXT stands for Business Experience and Technology.
Right.
It's the same trilogy, just slightly different labels. Yeah. Than I use. But I'd say just from, I've had the pleasure of working with an earlier prototype of the phone, and the thing that struck me really strongly about it was, it's clear just from looking at it, how Alex and the team approached it. And before they designed the phone, which is most people start doing the screens and how are we going to do this?
Sure. Well,
they designed the design language, the interaction language. And so this is the language so that, and if the team, all of the engineers and everybody understands that language in terms of this visual thing means that and these are the conventions, any user gets that as well. So then once you start to use it, even if you've never seen this screen or this other part before, you know how to use it because you know the language. It's just like when a child starts learning to speak, they can speak an infinite number of sentences even though they've never spoken them before because they understand the fundamentals of the language. And how to use graphic design and the body language, the gesture, and just the whole flow. And the critical thing, I think, in terms of experience design, as perhaps slightly different than graphic design, because there's different disciplines, is it's all about the flow. It's the transitions where the elegance happens. And if you notice it, it's probably wrong, other than the smile on your face. It's not the landing spots, it's how you move between them.
And is that an ongoing process, Albert? Like, does that continue for the life cycle of the product?
Yeah, it's definitely, I think, grounding it in those kind of our design language, where, once again, the set of principles that we, you know, really took to heart, not just in the design team, but in the engineering team, like, alive in motion was a big principle. Like, you know, the sense of space and spatial dimension through the use of motion and animation. And it wasn't something that, hey, you know, design thing, this is cool. We had to work the engineering team to actually implement a graphic system. Back to the BXT, it's you have to work hand in hand to actually deliver that. It's not making it pretty, it's actually making it authentically digital was another principle. That now we have a digital language, how do we make that true to itself? And not, it's not about, you know, applying, you know, Chrome or making it prettier.
Sure.
It's really authentic. And those type of principles really allow us to work with the engineering team and the business team to understand where we're going to build the product to make it better. So,
but establishing that language is the same thing as establishing your brand. And when everybody in the team understands, am I on brand or off brand? Am I in the language or out of the language? But there's another thing too, it's a lot like the natural language of speech. Like, we can all speak English, we have different accents, but we're native speakers. But the reality is, if we were putting this down for posterity, we'd probably sketch it out and we'd keep refining the English. It would always be English, it would always be articulate. But we'll get it to the point where it's really elegantly, it's really well said almost a type of poetry. So the quality of articulation and the use of that language is so well done that that instills a credibility to the concepts that that elegant language is speaking. And I'd say that some of the comments I've had when I've been working with the team is to really come and help just sort of, it's like the proofreader who's coming in and just sort of saying, hey, if you change the punctuation here and stuff like that, we can even get it better. But even to do that, you have to have something to work from. If you don't have really clear language, you can't say this is an ill-constructed sentence or not. And that's what I love about it because it makes it so much easier for anyone on the team, myself as somebody outside the team, or anyone else who's coming to actually help be constructive and to make the product ever better.
Yeah, and ultimately that speaks to also the partners and developer community that, hey, we're creating this language that allows you to go build a next, you know, the Sistine Chapel, or, you know, we're really, sure, from that architectural metaphor, we're laying the foundation, and this is what's the exciting part, that this language can extend and scale and move beyond, and you could go create the next chapter and the next stories and hopefully build richer and richer experiences.
That's great.
When I was at Mix last year, I talked to, there were a lot of designers and product developers and so on, and one of the most consistent things people come up and ask me about is sort of like, how when you're in a thing, when everybody has an opinion, everybody's an expert on UX or design, how do you turn changes from being a democracy? Like, everybody doesn't have a vote on what data structures you use, and yet everybody seems to feel that they're entitled to have a vote on whether we should do it this way or that way. When you have a well-established language, you all of a sudden have some criteria to say, here's why not.
Sure.
Because it clearly just doesn't fit. It doesn't matter if this is the most elegant way for this particular little part of the transaction to work, and you could make this improvement. It may be fine in this isolation, but if you look in the context of the whole, it stands out like a sore thumb. And if it's such a great idea, maybe we should change the whole language. But you know, that you might be able to do at the very beginning when you're a couple months away from shipping. That's not the best, most constructive contribution.
Yeah. Well,
so is developing that language then really the very first thing you should think about doing before you even start sketching on
You should develop five different languages.
Oh, five different languages. Okay.
Because how do you know you've got the right one? If you're going to spend all this time, and did you marry the first woman you ever met? I assume you're married.
No comment.
No. Why would you? You don't fall in love with first sight. It generally never lasts.
Sure.
If you're going to live with this product, this poor guy's been, he knows this metro language better than his family probably at this stage. After this thing, you spending more time with it probably.
Yeah, that's probably true.
For the next few months,
it's between Portland and Seattle. Yeah,
so. But the reality is that it's not just getting the design right, it's getting the right design. If you spent all this time as an engineer learning how to program, why would you program something that's not the best thing you could possibly ever build?
Sure.
And that's the part. The designers are there trying to help so that when we all invest our energies, the thing we invested on is the best we could have come up with, not our first idea, not the first thing that could plausibly work. And yet you never start from scratch. You go for examples. Design, always, you probably have about 5 to 7 different things you explore first. Map out the space, you understand the terrain, and say, okay, this is the route I'm going to take.
Okay. Yeah, and you use the same criteria between the BXT to allow you to decide which language fits best. And ultimately, one of the things that we learned along this experience is it is an evolution. It evolves. You add layers and you add texture to it, and you grow it, and hopefully, and this is the aspiration from the design team, is that, you know, we let other people in to that language and help us extend it. That's really the invitation here at Mix, is to really get that feedback and say, wow, I think we could really extend this into whole new areas.
And that's a really good point, because not only are both of you guys going to be presenting at Mix, but it's also an opportunity for Mix attendees to come and really talk to you face-to-face and ask these questions.
Totally, yeah.
and have these discussions right with you and with their peers in Vegas in about 2 weeks' time.
I don't go there to do the keynote or to give a keynote. That just lets me write it off as a business expense so that I can go talk to people.
He's buying drinks, by the way.
No, but the only value is you can actually... The challenge with a company like Microsoft is so large, especially if you're in a position like ours, is that we get to talk to developers or the people within the company. It's already 85,000 people there. It's the people who use it. And at Mix, you have this fantastic combination of people really literate on developing interactive stuff from the design and the engineering perspective. And they're really smart people. It would be insane not to tap that resource and listen to what they have to say. And it's not like you go there to sort of soak stuff up, but to engage in conversation with people who really understand what it is what we work with, and it brings us fresh ideas, it's stimulating, and man, I just spend the whole time in the hallway. I'm exhausted, but I'm invigorated.
That's awesome. Well, I want to change gears a little bit, and here's another question, a little bit different. Bill, is there an experience with a product in the physical world that we have yet to emulate online that really stands out to you? Is there something that we're still not really able to recreate in the online user experience space that exists in the physical world that you think is perhaps the evolution or the next step for, you know, user experience? And if so, you know, kind of what is it, and how would you go about trying to solve that? That's a big question. But
you see, here we go again. This time I'm not beating my wife. I'm just trying to think about what do we mean by online? Because when I'm driving my car, I'm online.
Sure.
You are? When I'm walking.
You shouldn't do that. You should just drive.
No. My car's online because it's been, if I have a car where I push the emergency thing. Have you ever pushed that button in the car when all of a sudden some answer, somebody, you hear that phone ring, you don't have a phone, and somebody comes in and says, hey, how can I help you? And it's somebody the OnStar thing?
Yeah, so normally you're in a paddock covered by sheep and things.
So anyhow, so I'm online. If I've got OnStar, I'm just not...
That's true.
Right?
That's true. Or if you have GPS.
Or GPS. The bandwidth is...
I just thought you were texting and driving, which I would not advocate.
I listen to the radio.
Oh, good.
I'm online, but it's unidirectional.
Okay. But I think the question was more around... So if you think about Xbox and driving games.
Sure.
And now we have steering wheels that allow us to emulate that experience of driving, which changes that from a physical experience that gets put on the screen and a way to interact with data and obviously play a game. And I suppose the question is more around, are there any more experiences like that that you think that we need to emulate in the user experience space? Does anything stand out?
So the thing about a lot of these driving games and so on is that where I think they make a mistake, and we see this in animation sometimes too, the closer you come to reality, actually, the less compelling the experience is.
Right, okay.
Because it's harder to suspend your disbelief.
Right.
And so there's one of the most important aspects of in animation and video games, I've worked in the film industry, is that finding that level where you conjure up the idea, but you don't come so close that you just see it as stupid or so on. So I used to work in theater doing sound effects, and the last thing you would do if somebody off stage was flushing a toilet is record a toilet flush and have it. You want to have a sound that sounds nothing like a toilet flush, but it evokes the notion of a toilet flush.
Right.
And the sound effects, but the Foley in video games and movies, those sounds, it's never the natural sound they record. They're caricatures that are far enough away that they actually go beyond and they
invoke the emotion,
and that's where the art comes, as opposed to just trying to copy reality. And in driving games, there's a lot of things where it's just you don't have the peripheral view and you don't have this, and so because I don't have that, even though I could make these other things realistic, I should distort them in a way that compensates for the weaknesses there. So I'll exaggerate this to compensate for the weaknesses of that, so I have a balanced experience. And those are the very subtle, intangible things that great game designers or great interaction designers know how to do. It comes right back to Disney.
The stretch and squeeze.
I'll give you another example. There's a psychology experiment that sort of said off people's recognition, and it sort of had people do hand poses. And they'd put up a flashcard and you had to copy the pose.
Right.
Now, I don't know if you know this, but in cartoons, they only have three fingers.
Yeah, well, three fingers and a thumb. Yeah.
And it turns out that if you show the pose in a photograph, a shaded drawing, line drawing, or the cartoon pose, the cartoon one's the one you can copy the fastest.
Really?
And it's not an accurate hand because there's the least amount of information there to parse to get the pose. Of course, if that was the pose, it won't work, right? But other than that.
So it's not lazy animators. There's a science behind it.
No, there's a really strong reason that it evokes the further from reality often distorts, because what you're seeing is it's not about reality. It's about it's about conjuring up the emotion and the response and with the minimum amount of stuff. At Pixar, they have a great line. It says, no matter how great something's in a scene, the response is always, can you make this movie without it?
Right.
And if you can, no matter how good it is, you take it out. And it's this economy. There's another great line that sort of says, the design isn't finished when there's nothing more to add. The design is finished when there's nothing more to take out.
Right.
And that's what I actually like about the phone, is that it's got this very, it's a lovely economy of design.
Yeah, and the principle, we like the idea of fierce reduction, it's, you know, you reduce to its core essence, then you add back on. I think that's a design approach that
that's
oftentimes...
That's a lovely term, by the way. Fierce reduction.
So it's oftentimes, it's easier to, it's very easy to say, let's add, you know, a lot of features, a lot of designs, and then try to figure out, well, how do we make it better versus... It's almost like the practice of design is actually making those choices of what to edit and what to get down to its core essence, and that's really, that's when you get to that kind of purity of the design, then you could change and build back up and go into many different directions.
Right. So. But here's where one of the most creative aspects of the design is not in the design of the product, certainly the design of the process is important, but the design of the specification. So my experience in some of the companies and projects I've worked on, I did one product where it was for designers to use in their studios, but it had to be a walk-up and use. And so the design specification was that any employee of General Motors, from the janitor to the president, had to be able to learn 80% of the functionality in 3 to 5 minutes with a 90% retention a week later.
Wow.
Or that was a stop ship bug, no matter if every line of code was perfect and every function was perfectly implemented and provably and demonstrably so. And what was interesting was, is that when you add the same kind of creativity to the specification to reflect what your design objective is, the engineers, for example, who always are trying to improve their product, they're never trying to break it, but they often will add things to it that weren't in the spec. And in some sense, individually, they do add something, but in the holistic view, they take away because they add complexity that's incoherent often. In this case, they beat the spec, but they proved how good they were by saying, forget this 80%, we're going to make it 90% in 2 minutes, right? And it's gonna, they're gonna have 100% retention, right? They want to excel because they're so eager to make the best product they can within what they're trained to do. And they train to be great programmers. And that's why they're not necessarily great designers. In exactly the same sense, the designers train to be great designers, and that's why you don't want them writing the code, right? But together, neither is sufficient, but together, then you can do that. But that spec, how you design that in itself, it's these little details that really change the whole focus of the team. Do that. Have the design language coherent. Have people working together from the beginning so you're not feeling I'm just cleaning up your mess type of thing. Then you have this respect that, and this collegiality. It's like the sax player and the trumpet player in the band aren't better. They're just different.
Yeah, it becomes more harmonious. That
yeah.
way.
You play in harmony. It's exactly right.
That's right. I mean, getting back to, I think, the question, actually, we've been thinking a lot about this idea of analog and digital. And,
sure.
You know, it's kind of the physical, and you know, it's always the age-old UX metaphor.
Yeah.
Like, do I want my desktop, the virtual desktop on my computer? And it's, you know, the alarm clock, the you know, everything's always been this kind of translation from the physical world in a very literal metaphor.
Yeah.
And we've always, that's a good UX problem that we have fun debating. I'm not sure everyone has fun debating that, but... but it's one of those things that, you know, when we say authentically digital, we really thought that mobile phones is not your PC, and that we do need to shift the metaphor, shift perspective, and that, you know, especially as we look at digital print and print media and you know, typography and the use of typography in the digital world versus in print, we really strive for a lot of these design elements to think differently about how do we use analog design elements in a digital world. Mm-hmm. And one area is typography and the richness of typography. We really invested in that. And we feel those are the things that we think in the analog world hasn't been really translated well in the digital world. And we're striving to do a lot more to bring the rich sense of typography into our products. So that's probably one key element of that we think could be really take advantage of. So
on a related note, in the Windows Phone space, the Windows Phone 7 space, you know, multi-touch is such a massive buzzword in the industry, and it seems to be not just in the mobile space; it's also in the desktop and the PC space as well. I suppose the question is, when to multi-touch and not to multi-touch? The pros and cons of multi-touch. You know, are there? You know, I think most people would think that in order to have a modern user experience, you have to have multi-touch. Is that the case? Is multi-touch synonymous with?
I've heard about this multi-touch.
Modern.
So Bill has more history than I have.
I have a pen that has multi-touch. It's really cool. You can use both buttons.
So
you can have that later. Well, Bill, did you want to answer this question? Well, to both of you, multi-touch. Yeah. When? What do you think?
Well, I would kind of rewind the clock probably a bit.
All right.
So just to set some context, you may not. I guess I published the first paper in multi-touch in 1985.
Yes, I was looking at that beforehand. I couldn't remember the date.
It was a little while ago, and so.
I think
it's kind of important and useful.
Sure.
But I have a rule. Everything's best for something and worst for something else.
Okay.
And before you go advocating this as some panacea, the new black, right, or whatever, if you can articulate as succinctly when it sucks as well as you can when it's great.
Right.
Basically, its weaknesses as well as its strengths. You probably don't understand it enough to be an advocate.
Okay.
Go back and do your homework and come back and understand when to use it. So multi-touch has some great attributes, but understand, with a few exceptions, you can't touch type on it. It's useless for that. There's a whole generation of 12-year-old girls in the United Kingdom who can sit there in class and Twitter or SMS under the desk while answering a math question from their teacher, and nobody can tell. When you put a touch sensitive keyboard, you can't do that.
Sure.
Now, once you understand that and you analyze it, there are ways to do what I call touch writing on a touch screen, but nobody's done that since Casio did it in 1984.
Okay.
It's the last time you could do that.
Wow.
But on the other hand, there's things you can do with multi-touch, like just the obvious gestures of pinching, the fluency of that, and moving around. We're working at MSR. I'm going to show a demo at Mix of some stuff around painting and so on. Let's go back to finger painting, finger painting on steroids, which that's all I'm going to say. but it makes multi-touch. I'm going to do the demo. I swear I would never do it, Mix.
Well, at least you're doing it on steroids.
But I'm going to do it. Yes, that's right. And the Olympics are over, so I'm safe. And being a Canadian. It's a question of. So, you don't understand. There's this Canadian mafia.
Well, I suppose we're all.
It's a Commonwealth.
Commonwealth, yes. So, God save the Queen.
Yeah. Yes. But I think yes, it's great. It's not great for everything.
Okay.
That's about it. And the last word isn't out on touch, because the other thing is that even all multi-touch technologies are not the same.
Sure.
There's very, very different properties on different technologies.
Is that a good lead-in for
yeah, well, I think, like Bill was saying, there's some great uses for it and there's some not so great uses. And one of the things that, when we designed the phone, I think we really focus more on content. Content's king. Mm-hmm. And I think what touch does, well, is I think it's a bit more immersive. It's direct. It's really, you're touching and so there's a sense of, that touch, there's a more emotional connection, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm actually manipulating a photo, it's my photo, and I feel like I'm more directly in contact, literally, with the things I care about.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's richness in that experience.
And gestural.
And there are things that, it's very personal in terms of, touch typing. Some people actually can touch type it's almost like playing piano blind, where you're referencing the physical. I think it's between the hardware and the software where you actually bring touch alive.
Mm-hmm.
And those are things that we're exploring to make touch come to life for our users in a deeper and richer way. So like Bill was saying, it's just a start. I think there's a lot more ideas we have that we barely, I think, scratch the surface.
But Bill, actually, just coming back to your original point, you mentioned previously, multi-touch is not a new concept. It's been around for a very long time. Are we seeing, is this just another evolutionary jump in how multi-touch is used as a way to interact with not only devices but user experiences?
Well, yes and no. There's got to be some benefit for being old. And God, there's so few of them, I'm going to take advantage every chance I can. But there is a certain amount of having lived through some of this history. Good thing to remember, the mouse took 30 years to become ubiquitous.
Sure.
It was invented in 65. I first used one in 71 at the National Research Council in Canada. Xerox PARC got one in around 1972. It came out on the Xerox Star in 82, Macintosh 84, Windows 95 than I was everywhere, 30 years. It was obviously the right thing to do. And yet, last year, I showed at Mix this Arc mouse from Microsoft, and it's just this beautiful, beautiful mouse. They're still innovating, right, on this thing. So there's still, the paperclip's still getting innovated on, right? So,
that's true.
So you could say it's just part of this evolution.
Sure.
But that is not quite accurate, because there are places where you hit a sweet spot and you get a ramp up, and even if it's the same idea, but there's an order of magnitude more of them. I have this thing called the order of magnitude rule that says when something changes by an order of magnitude, more of them, faster, cheaper, or just, in size, or whatever, that it becomes a different thing. Just because it's multi-touch, that's the most visible attribute, so we describe it that way. But that's actually not what makes the difference. And it happens to be something that makes a difference that involves multi-touch. So we just attribute it to the multi-touch. And the great designers, I think, are the ones that, while everybody else is sort of saying, oh, it's multi-touch, it's actually not multi-touch. It's engagement. Right. And so what we've changed is the nature of engagement and immediacy. And it just happens that multi-touch is what's giving it right now. But that's the change. And in fact, we could get it through. And now if you understand what I just said, then it provokes you to look at what are other ways we can get similar engagement.
Right.
And extend that engagement as opposed to extend multi-touch. Yeah. One's about technology, the other's about an emotional attachment, gratification, excitement, and flow, and engagement, and ability to get transparent access to my intent, my desires, through this technological intermediary. And that's the game that we play, and that's what we train our eyes to see and how to think and how to analyze things.
Right. Well, I think we might start to wrap it up. Albert, what are some of the topics? I mean, you'll obviously be at Mix. Obviously, Windows Phone 7 will be very much top of mind. What are some of the things you'll be talking about in your discussions? And if someone sees you at Mix and they want to come up to you and say hi, what are some of the questions they should ask, or what should they engage you with?
I'm from, my hometown is Winnipeg. Maybe that's
a good.
That's a start. But
it's mosquito capital of the world.
Wow. That's true.
And the home of Guess Who and Neil Young.
That's true.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
There you go.
Burton Turner Overdrive.
Yeah.
Wow, it's the...
Lenny Bro.
Anyways, so at Mix, we can talk a lot about Canadian trivia. But
so if, curling, hockey, Neil Young.
But I think, hopefully at Mix, I there's little three things hopefully I can accomplish. I think one is inspire. I think we're really excited about the design, and we want to bring some of that kind of design thinking to the audience and talk about, hey, where did our Metro design language come from, and hopefully share that. But also, I think there's a chance to talk about how to design applications that extends the experiences that we've talked about, be it making it more personal, make it more connected and more relevant. How do we, what is good user-centered design philosophy, an approach that we could share? And then and the third one is, boy, I think I'm really amazed at all the great tools that we build and we're going to offer up at Mix. And we're really excited, and hopefully you are too, that we're going to delight you with some of the tools we're building to help you create great experience and great applications. So those are the three things. And ultimately, I really just want to be there and absorb and get kind of take in some of the energy and some of the ideas and share some of our ideas and then really have that great exchange at Mix. And I think that's the opportunity and the forum for us to really roll up our sleeves and talk about what we're excited about, which is building amazing experiences. So
great. And I probably shouldn't ask, but Bill...
I'm actually, and I'll just leave it at this because I know we're
because we know you're time. Roaming the corridors,
yeah,
just looking for random conversations.
Buying drinks.
Remember my degree is in music, and so therefore I'm going to give a treatise on the principal song from the Broadway hit musical Annie Get Your Gun.
Wow!
And it's about Annie Oakley. So
wow.
That's what I'm going to do at Mix.
Very cool.
And I'm going there to be inspired.
Fantastic. Well, guys, thank you very much for your time. Hopefully, those of you watching, this is some food for thought for the Mix conference coming up in 2 weeks. Stay tuned to Channel 9 and the Visit Mix website. We'll see you guys in Vegas. Thanks very much.
Our pleasure.
Great. Thanks.